Religious reductionism. Conventional Western religion, like Western science, evolved within the same milieu of reducing and commodifying large animals and tends to be similarly reductionist in its essential orientation. The infinite divine mystery is typically reduced to a judgmental and often anthropomorphized authority figure. Humans are reduced to self-centered, discrete, temporal entities who may be chosen or saved or condemned to eternities of hell or heaven based on one fleeting lifetime. And animals, trees, ecosystems, and all of nature are reduced to being mere disposable props in this drama. Like science, the religious establishment has tended to reinforce the domination of animals, women, and nature, and to further the interests of the ruling elite. Like science, it tends toward being hierarchical, patriarchal, and exclusivist. And, like science, it tells us to rely not on our own inner wisdom, but on its outside authority. Like reductionist science, which insists on the objectivist split between self and world, conventional Western religion insists on the primary dualism of creator and creation, God and the world. This belief in a basic disconnection between the divine and all of us reinforces the illusion of separateness that is also propagated by reductionist science. It is fascinating and instructive that while conventional science and religion fight endlessly with each other, bickering brothers sharing a common reductionist mythology, holistic science finds inspiring and helpful guidance and confirmation from progressive and non-Western religious traditions like liberation theology and many indigenous traditions, as well as Eastern traditions such as Taoism, Mahayana Buddhism, Sikhism, and Vedanta. These religious traditions tend to have evolved in cultures and subcultures in which animals were not systematically reduced to commodities. The reductionist delusion of essential separateness is so ritualized in our daily meals that it inevitably thrusts itself into our religious lives. We are often told as children that we'll be excluded from heaven unless we subscribe to a set of exclusivist beliefs. Mainstream religious teachings typically tell us we are special if we agree to an exclusivist creed. They rarely question our violent food choices, but rather encourage them by declaring that animals have no souls and that God gave us animals to eat. And they sponsor barbecues, pig roasts, fish fries, and turkey dinners in communities across America. It wasn't too long ago when the 4th century emperor Constantine made Christianity the Roman state religion that its earlier vegetarian emphasis was completely repressed and actually became a heresy, with Constantine reportedly ordering his men to pour molten lead down the throats of any Christians who refused to eat animal flesh. The original Christian teachings of mercy had to be repressed and twisted in order to be accepted by the dominant herding culture, and the enlightened teaching that he who lives by the sword must die by the sword became a bitter irony. By interpreting the transcendent divine as masculine, conventional religion deifies the masculine the same way science does and suppresses the feminine, which nurtures and connects. Even today, when there is virtually no theologian who would dare argue that the infinite spirit that is referred to by the word God could be said to be more male than female, we still teach our children, as we were taught, that he is the Lord. In the old herding cultures, it was males who warred, herded, raped, and it is still basically the same today. By emphasizing the masculine nature of God, the herding cultures legitimized their ethos of domination, cruelty, and killing. In fact, as J.R. Hyland points out, the main form of worship in the old herding cultures was the sacrificial killing of animals to please the deity. Underlying all this was the fundamental notion that, quote, "the Lord is my shepherd," end quote. A terrifying idea when we contemplate the realities of the herding culture that propagated these teachings. The herder enslaved, castrated, and killed his sheep, goats, and cattle without mercy, and these creatures were, as they are today, powerless in his almighty hands. The anxious preoccupation with being, quote, saved, perhaps derives directly from this. Our ongoing failure to save the animals at our mercy may compel us into nervous concern about our own salvation. Salvation from what, exactly? From the consequences of our actions, perhaps? Or, more traditionally, from being damned to the fires of hell? Whence comes the power of this image? Could it be related to the untold centuries of herders gazing through flames into the charring bodies of animals they've condemned and killed as sacrificial offerings, in which they themselves will eat? The myth of evil. The basic view promoted by conventional Western religion is of an unending battle between good and evil, with God as a male, sky-dwelling deity on one side, and Satan as a shadowy, malicious, bestial presence on the other. This devil is ironically represented as having the horns and hooves of a goat or cow, the very victims we relentlessly confine and attack for food. This evil or devil is certainly, on one level at least, the projection of our own shadow. The guilt, shame, and unexpressed grief we bear for the massive ongoing cruelty we engage in as eaters of animals in the herding culture's households. We repress our awareness of our cruelty and consequently find ourselves plagued by a dark and sinister presence. This is unavoidable because the evil we see is our own denied and unadmitted cruelty from which we can never distance ourselves. It emerges as devils, enemies, wars, and weapons of mass destruction. We are told we have to side with our shepherd king who protects us but also controls us in his war with the enemy. Animals and the earth are seen as mere properties and stage for this cosmic battle at best. At worst, animals and the earth and women and minorities are seen as somehow in league with the dark, shadowy devil and therefore rightfully, quote, subdued, end quote. This lurking sense that we are basically evil, one of the characteristic traits of our Western culture, is a mainstay belief propagated by the religious establishment. It isn't necessary, though, and there is plenty in both the Old and New Testaments of the Bible to refute it. Matthew Fox argues, for example, in Original Blessing, that the doctrine of original sin, that we are by nature evil and depraved, is not founded upon either the core teachings of Jesus or the experience and writings of many of the recognized illumined Christian and Jewish sages and mystics. These people have discovered the fundamental goodness of life and human nature and the original blessing at the heart of creation as an ongoing celebration and evolution of consciousness. In the Eastern religious traditions, which tend to discourage meat-eating and animal herding and are somewhat less dualistic than our Western traditions, this fundamentally positive orientation is well established. In Buddhism, for example, it is a core teaching that all sentient beings have Buddha nature, that is, that all beings are expressions of completely enlightened consciousness and can realize this directly through spiritual growth and understanding. This basic goodness is seen as our true nature and is the foundation of our spiritual practice. Many increasingly progressive strands within Western religious traditions similarly recognize that human nature, and all nature, is a reflection of divine love and is essentially good. Our spiritual path consists of contacting this inner light and purifying ourselves to be lambent vessels for its luminous presence. The idea that we are fundamentally evil goes as completely against this universal idea of our original goodness as our ugly practice of confining and killing animals goes against our innate sense of kindness. The herding culture we were all born into carries an enormous reservoir of hidden guilt for the ferocious savagery it inflicts on animals for food, for the abuse and hardening of its boys, and for the violence it propagates against women and against rival herders and nations. This systematic cruelty and the repressed but healthy sense of compunction that naturally goes with it are the source of our cultural belief that people are inherently evil. The deep-seated sense of guilt, fear, and anxiety arising from this infects all of us unconsciously and causes us many problems, physically, mentally, and spiritually. Because of this, we find there is today a growing movement that urges freedom from guilt trips and judgment. We recognize that chronic guilt cripples us, depletes our energy, and keeps us trapped in old patterns, and we understandably want to be free of it, but we don't see that its source is in the ongoing cruelty of our daily meals. Thoughts and behavior produce after their kind. We can thus see how difficult it is to effectively address and reduce the suffering caused to animals through vivisection, rodeos, circuses, canned hunts, dogfighting rings, and so forth, while as a culture we still practice eating them. The desensitization inherent in reducing animals for food naturally expands to animals mistreated in non-food uses as well. But it doesn't just stop there at the boundary of animals. This is why, quote, man's inhumanity to man, end quote, is rooted in our inhumanity to animals. Conventional religion, like science, accurately reflects the psychological trauma of the herding culture that birthed it and that still sustains it. Everything is justified by the culture's living mythology. As Joseph Campbell points out in The Masks of God, cultures dependent on animal flesh organize themselves around death because, quote, the paramount object of experience is the beast, killed and slaughtered, end quote. This is true of our culture today, and the deaths of the millions of animals slaughtered daily ripple through all our religious institutions, which provide the mythos to justify it now as they did in the arid hills of the Mediterranean basin 3,000 years ago. Plant-based cultures, Campbell points out, organize themselves around life. The plant world provides, quote, the food, clothing, and shelter of people since time out of mind, but also our model for the wonder of life, in its cycle of growth and decay, blossom and seed, wherein death and life appear as transformations of a single, superordinated, indestructible force, end quote. The revolution desperately needed today, if we are to survive, is a transformation of the basic orientation of the herding culture into which we were born, from a mythos of death and reductionism to a mythos of life and holism. A transformation of science and religion and economics, releasing them from obsolete reductionism and orienting them toward furthering and celebrating universal compassion and the interconnectedness of all beings. It is possible when we change our daily eating habits and the mentality of disconnectedness they require. Although we are products of the herding culture, we can heal it and ourselves through understanding. This understanding requires a change in our behavior because our behavior strongly conditions our consciousness. The science and religion and economics of holism, kindness, sustainability, and community begin with this. As we cultivate awareness and question the death orientation that stares at us from our plates, we can create a field of freedom and compassion. And as we move to plant-based meals, we can become agents of life, breathing a new spirit of protecting and including into our world that, by blessing the animals who are at our mercy, will bless us 100-fold. This is a radical transformation because it goes, as the word radical implies, to the essential root of our unyielding dilemma, the commodification of animals for food.